You're listening to Naked League Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 231 is Chris Church, a singer-songwriter, guitarist, bass player based in North Carolina, started in the early 90s in a couple different bands, including Flat Earth, whose song Every Time from the 1991 album Precipice you're listening to right now. His first album under his own name, Aura Lollipop, came out in 1992. He's just released his 13th album under his own name, Obsolete Path. We'll talk about the single from that, She Looks Good in Black. Then we'll look back to his Limitations from the Source Tape album, 2017. The song is Intransitive Proverb. And look quite far back to Your Own Chosen Speed, an album from 2001. The song is Angel Be Mine. In addition to those many solo albums, he's continued to play with other people under various band names, one of which is Dang. And we'll conclude by listening to Sisyphus from their 2014 album, Tartarus, The Darkest Realm. For more information, look up Chris Church on Bandcamp.com. He's got his own page and the Big Stir Records page that has his most recent releases. For more about this podcast, see NakedlyExaminedMusic.com. And if you want to support the effort, go to Patreon.com/NakedlyExaminedMusic. So I will play a little bit of Every Time by Flat Earth from Precipice from 1991. Is that the correct pronunciation of the made-up word?
I don't really know that there should be one, but I would always say precipice.
Okay.
Because it's combining the word preface and precipice, and it was just kind of silly, and we stuck with it.
So I'd chosen this. Well, I don't know if this song in particular, there just happened to be a video of it that you had posted, whether this was a standout single or something. It seemed like a fine little intro there, and that this was also your brush with greatness. I don't know. You said in the description of that, that you this three piece opened for what, the Kinks, Blue Oyster Cult?
Yeah, we had a long period of being the opening band in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. And we got to open up for quite a few big names. Peter Frampton, Blue Oyster Cult, Toad the Wet Sprocket, Driving and Crying, Joan Jett, Billy Squire, Kansas, King's X, and more.
And so was there a straight line to, we can get a label deal with this? And was this the point of where you were trying to break in, as opposed to, I'm going to have a long-term indie career where I just produce as much as I want at my own pace and I'm not responsible for anybody?
Well, the honest answer is we didn't know what we were doing. We only had a manager for a brief period of time, and I still don't know if he knew what he was doing either. But the way we got most of those gigs was because my best buddy, Scott Cornette, the guitar player for Flat Earth, who's done a lot of music with me, he was working in radio at that time, and he got to interview a lot of these folks, and we got a line directly to a couple of clubs through some people that we met. And when these bigger names or midline kind of names of rock and roll music at that period of time in the early 90s would come through, we were the first people called if they didn't bring their own opening band. We got lucky. We didn't make much money or move our name very far, but it sure was an experience, and it was a lot of fun, a lot of work. It was a lesson. I value that time and I cherish it, and taught us a lot about what to do and what not to do in front of an audience.
And then I saw you had several bands in that period, Junk Flower, that you were not the singer of. Yeah. Did these overlap?
Yeah.
Were you, but you were also working? Okay. So how did you see, I mean, was this sort of fresh out of school, just I'm trying to do music full time? How did these things fit together?
One of the main reasons I was in both bands at the same time was because Flat Earth was progressive metal and Junk Flower was more pop rock. And I wanted to do both at that time. And I was lucky enough to have some good friends to try that with. Again, no inkling of what to do with it. No inkling of a path or anything. It was just all by the scruff of our necks. We didn't do anything but try to get the next gig. We'd practice our songs and write more songs and try to get the next gig. That's as far as I looked, or any of us really.
All right. So 18, 20 albums later, a lot of releases, let's say that. You have many more releases than albums, but we want to talk about the new one, Obsolete Path, She Looks Good in Black. Do you want to just say a little bit about where you're at now and this record? I mean, this is, you picked this because it's the big single, and I respect, like, yes, let's lead people off with the thing that is the most successful power pop catchy thing. But yeah, say a little about this quintessential type of song here and what you're doing.
She Looks Good in Black is, if there's anything I do that I kind of repeat the process, it's that wistful kind of power pop thing that's got a maybe one toe in the Americana, also pop rock, kind of like the Gin Blossoms or maybe some Matthew Sweet kind of stuff. That's my wheelhouse. And I go back to that quite a bit. That's the track on Obsolete Path, my new record, that I think fits that bill pretty well. And people seem to like it. And it's got a cute little story, if you have time, about how my wife and I get along really well. And I don't have a lot of things to complain about or get too serious about or write sad bastard songs about. So I will invent things. And when she leaves, even if it's just for a day or a few days or something, I will write an imaginary song about how she's gone for good. And this is another one of those.
Okay.
She was going to see this satanic band, this satanic doo-wop band called Twin Temple with her friend. And by the time she arrived at the show, I had already written most of the song. And it's She Looks Good in Black, being the fact that this guy's bemoaning his girl who suddenly turned goth and held Satan's hand instead of his. But I made it work into something sort of believable, I think, I hope. But people have seemed to like it, and we've made a video.
Yes, I will link folks to that.
Thank you.
Yeah, say a little about the construction of the, are you playing 12 string, or are you just thicking it up so it sort of sounds 12 stringy?
For this album, the vast majority of the guitars were Telecaster. I've got a Fender Telecaster. That's my best buddy. I dropped acoustic guitars in on this one, on this song, for sure. Did that on a few other ones. And as the process went forward, I kept on feeling really good about this acoustic guitar because an old friend had given it to me. Good friend of my mom and dad. He gave me a 1958, I believe it is, Gibson acoustic guitar. And he's, in his words, gotten too old to play it. And he gave it to me. He showed me the first guitar chords I ever learned when I was a little kid. And it's just so sweet of him to do that. And it took me a long time to get up the gumption to try to do something with it on my own, because I felt like it was just relic, this antique that I couldn't touch. But I got it out and it spoke to me. And I actually, there are a couple songs on the new record that are pretty much just acoustic. And I just was so fortunate to be able to use that guitar and make it work for me. Dropped it in on some electric driven songs. I don't do that often, but I felt like it worked, and definitely went more towards some acoustic music. And probably the big star of the album, as far as instruments go, I did stay pretty much with the Telecaster for electric guitars, but I think maybe I used my Gibson Les Paul a time or two, mostly Telecaster, a little bit of acoustic here and there. And the drummer, Brian Beaver, who's also in my heavy metal band called Dang, he expressed interest in doing this pop music with me, which is heretofore unlike him. He's an experimental and metal guy, but he just fit in so well. So we started sounding like a band, just the two of us. And I went for that. I kept on riding that train. It worked out pretty well.
Yes. If you told me this was Prairie Prince playing drums, you know, or the XTC albums where he guested on is what I have specifically in mind. I wouldn't have been surprised. Very minimalist, not overly so, but just, yeah, it does not sound like a heap of metal influence. But I think one of the stories of listening through your catalog is like the power pop, the power. I think it's not that uncommon for people to drift into metal, right? Weezer or whatever that they have. They're just as influenced by Kiss as by the Kinks or something like that.
I think that happens pretty often. I think you're dead on there. And I grew up listening to hard rock. I didn't even know what power pop was until a certain point, probably in the late 80s. I caught myself enjoying stuff like the band Stars is, I guess, a deep cut, but they have an album called Attention Shoppers, and it's straight up power pop most of the way through. But everybody that knows who Stars was talks about their other records, which are hard rock. And I was like defending this little thing, feeling like I was the only guy in the world that knew some of those songs. Hold On to the Night, if you want to look it up, by Stars, STARZ. Power pop classic, and nobody knows it. But I didn't realize that that was even in there. And I started gravitating towards more of that. And I was like, wow, this is really just hard rock without as many riffs in it. Maybe a few better lyrics, maybe a few less gonna get you girl kind of lyrics, but it's still plaintively, will you be with me girl? Kind of just a different side of that coin. It's the same thing, really, just a bunch of horny guys talking about girls, really. Same thing in a way.
I guess the reference is to Satanic Band, like as if this is not you're not going in that direction with this band, but the fact that when you're talking about goth things or whatever, how much tendency is there to want to like musically acknowledge that to something? Or no, you're just, this is the narrator. That's the alternative.
I'm not sure if I'm answering your question correctly, but the metal band that I'm in, Dang, I don't have to worry about that at all, because all of my lyrics are tongue-in-cheek retellings of stories from Greek mythology. And some of it's funny and some of it's ridiculous, but it really is staying pretty close to the tales of Sisyphus and
sure,
all of those characters that are doomed to the lowest parts of hell. So it's grisly, but it's also hilarious. I don't try to put any commentary personally into it. I'm just telling a tongue-in-cheek version of the stories that are already there.
Sure. So the fact that you do that other project, which we will hear some of at the very end of this interview, seems to add some depth to you talking about it in this song. That it's as if, you know, that's your other band, even though this was a specific thing. That is interesting that you, because yes, it seems wistful, but the fact that like, if someone really, if your life has fallen apart and the person has left you for good, it seems like this is playing with that idea as opposed to
experiencing it, right? That the fact that she looks good in black is the tagline that you're repeating over and over in increasingly wistful ways. But that's not a particularly wistful, I don't know, what made you pick that? Obviously, it's catchy, but pick that as the thing to sort of stick on as this is going to be, I'm going to just have to get the poignancy out of what chords are going on behind it, because there's nothing particularly poignant about that phrase.
Maybe I take it for granted, but I've always thought that people would agree. Artists who go through traumatic things in their lives and have that depth of visibility and self-awareness can translate into some of the best art. And most of the time that comes from a very sad place and you're trying to work some stuff out. And I've been through a lot of trauma in my life, but I have chosen to not revisit that unless I'm going to create an arc, make it make sense to me in a way that is hopefully people can relate to it. But it's more important to me that I like it. It's more important to me that I get, even if it's an in joke that only I know, I would rather do that than try to make something just to titillate or turn someone's head or whatever. And like I said, my wife, Lori, and I, we have such a good relationship that she doesn't give me things to feel traumatized about.
Sure, sure.
I don't have that depth of emotion. I can't pretend to be a sad bastard anymore. So I kind of invent it.
Well, and the fact that at the end of the song, it sort of flicks into this Rolling Stones blues thing with hand claps was my note that, like, yes, this has been a jokey exercise. This is not actually somebody, you know, you can actually enjoy this without being at that low point.
Yeah. I wouldn't call it jokey. It is less dark, perhaps.
Let's say underlyingly joyful.
And that's just it. I would rather commit fully to something that's just so heartbreaking or weirdly blown out than to just dabble in it. If you're going to try to access the side of you, it's my opinion as an artist, if you're going to try to access the trauma and the darkness that you've gone through, either do it all the way or just come up with your version of it. Don't just throw out a tidbit here and there. My version of it is to kind of make it bittersweet, land in the middle somewhere. Mm-hmm. That's always been my favorite kind of music.
So did you start on bass instead of guitar? I know that you played that in Flat Earth, and the bass line seems very integral in this song, the way it's sort of answering the main line.
No, I started on guitar, and I was in a heavy metal cover band when I was like 17 years old or so. And the first real band that I had was a band called The Jones, and I was the guitarist. We were a three-piece. And the bass player and my brother on drums, my late great brother, played in both The Jones and Flat Earth. The evolution of what I was into musically has always, I am still evolving, I'm devolving, but there's a straight line only in the ideals of it. I don't tend to see that much difference between progressive rock and heavy metal and power pop if the feeling is the same. And I do feel like the whole thing is just keep going, just do what feels right to you. And as far as playing bass, I've never really separated that so much from guitar. I think I play bass more to a guitarist kind of bass playing, maybe more like Bill Wyman than Victor Wooten.
Sure. So you're playing with a pick.
Yeah, there's nothing fancy going on with my bass playing other than finding notes that I love.
Yes, and making it click in. Have you messed around? Are there recordings of you playing drums that you just go ahead and... Or do you always try to get somebody else that is a little more comfortable?
I have two records that have been released that I'm playing the drums on. Mm-hmm. One of them was Darling Please. That's on Big Stir Records. Darling Please was more of a tribute to my late great brother. And I did it just kind of to try to do it, to get that done was cathartic for me. The other one, Game Dirt, is I'm a happy little mess of a record. I was just going for whatever. It was during the pandemic and I was just floating out ideas, and they were all basically demos. I'm by no means a good drummer. I'm not even competent, but I would get through the song and I'd be, hey, made it to the end of that one. And that was good enough. I wanted to make a record like that. I wanted it to be immediate and imperfect and see if the warts could just be just as pretty as the eyeshadow, so to speak.
I mean, you'd mentioned you and Brian sort of becoming a band, just the two of you on this. And I know that that's so, for instance, Jay Maskus and Dinosaur Jr., that he the fact that he's a guitarist and a drummer, that he wants to get somebody, just some other voice, in his case, bass, in your case, drums, but somebody to make it sound a little more three-dimensional. So it's not just, you know, that you're following yourself. Is there any process when you switch from guitar to bass that you're trying to forget a little bit? Are you trying to like really follow? It sounds like you're not, you know, there are lots of guitar players who play bass that just follow the chords and the rhythm exactly. And you're clearly not doing that.
Right.
You're more musical than that.
I do have a bit of a cheat that I use, not on every song, but occasionally. What I tend to do, especially if we're playing in the same room, I'll play guitar. And then when I'm laying down the bass, the drum track is already there. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll do that to where the drum track being already there, I can put accentuation moments together to where I'm hitting the same pattern. I'll create a pattern of notes that sound the same percussively as the drum parts do. I'm very fortunate to know several great drummers. And, you know, within the last 10 years, I've had four or five drummers that I know that are just excellent. And I'd be lucky to have any of them. Circumstances dictate whether or not I'm going to be able to work with John Hawkins or Nick Bertling or John Leeds or Brian Beaver. There's several people that I know that happen to be great drummers. Pretty lucky in that regard that I can call on them and they'll be there.
As far as the harmonies go, so I've had Lindsay Murray on this show, who's doing the harmonies here. Clearly you just let her do stuff from her house, right?
Correct.
And were you telling her at all where to put the, or were you just like, here's your canvas, and how much of what, like, were there things that she sent back that you didn't use because maybe it was a little, you know, I just wanted to come in this space, or that, how did that relation work?
There is very little that she's ever done or sent me that I don't use because she's got the voice of an angel. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's pretty close to 50-50. I do lay out plans and I show her what I want. And there have been times when I've sent her demos where I'm singing all of the background vocals. Mm. She just does them better. And it's clear. It's obvious. So I don't worry about her. And when she throws something in that she's come up with, it's always good every time.
I'm getting pelted now whenever I go on Facebook with these ads for various plugins, including these AI ones of, yes, in the future, you'll be able to sing that part yourself. And then, you know, it'll call up one of the voices from its library and, oh, I've got now I have probably not, you know, Prince is not giving his permission to this. But, you know, a angelic female voice, a high soul singing guy. And of course, it's wonderful when you have an actual connection with a real musician. But I can sort of see, just to like not have to spend any more time sending files just to do it, but yet to have it sound like more of, I don't know, does that sound like an unholy?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Something I'm never going to do, I can promise you.
I mean, are you pitch correcting? I don't hear a huge amount of, okay, not at all.
I don't do any of that stuff ever. And I like records that have, as I said earlier, warts on them or whatever you want to call it, just imperfections. Because how many times have you heard something and the first time you hear it, it's like, oh, did they mean to do that? And then by the time you've heard it 10 times, you could not do without it. It's like one of the biggest reasons to love the Rolling Stones is to notice what sounds like half of the thing they were trying, and Keith will do a hiccup and Ronnie will do a note that sounds a little odd or whatever. And I don't need to explain that. Everybody knows what that is, but I want that. I want to get it right. I want to play it correctly. But if there's something in there that isn't quite perfect, that to me usually just makes it more special because it shows the trying, the aspect of giving her, as they say. I enjoy that a lot. I like to hear it sound more real.
Well, so for instance, if you're layering three guitars on this, are you doing a full pass on each sound? If I'm doing that, by the time I'm hitting the third guitar, well, that's the sweetener. And I just will punch in a lot, basically, to, you know, okay, and kind of arrange the parts as I'm laying them down. Would that violate your ethic?
Okay. Not at all. That goes all the way back to Jimmy Page when you're hearing something like the Wanton song from Led Zeppelin, Physical Graffiti. What sticks out probably more than anything on that one, first think about it, is the volume swell. Mm-hmm. You can't just do that and get it right unless you get lucky. And Jimmy Page notoriously added a bunch of guitar tracks, but on some songs he did not. It just depended on what you felt in the moment for that song. And of course I'll go back and hear something after I've already said I'm through with it. And I'll listen to it days or weeks or months later and go, man, I should have not done that. Or I should have added one more right there. But you have to just learn to trust yourself and feel your way through it and feel like you've done the thing that reaches your goal for you. And at that point, if you keep on fussing with it, you're Steely Dan.
Well, let me play just one of those potential punch-in points. So the interlude where you have an extra guitar that seems to come in to add a little sweetener here. Let me just play it. Just that one, you know, that extra thing. So
interesting little moment that you picked there, because one of those guitars is in standard tuning and one of those guitars is not. And it actually gave me a little bit of a different vibe when I heard it. It turned out to be the last note of those little solo progressions right there. It turned out to be a harmonic note instead of exact repeat. So you've got the exact repeat and a harmonic note in the same run, just because of the dadgad tuning and open tuning versus the standard tuning. And I'm playing it very close to the same way. And little moments like that, I try for things like that. I use a different tuning here and there. And if it adds some flavor to it that is worthwhile, I'll let that happen. Sure. I love doing that.
And let me play one more place. So this is around 148. If I can endure, carry on. The chords thicken. So the second song we're going to play in just a few minutes here, I had picked because of its more Todd Rundgren-esque chord progression. A lot of power pop guys, just very straight, major minor chords. Yes, a seventh here and there, but nothing crazier than the Beatles would do, certainly. You know, which of course is a pretty broad palette, but they don't do Steely Dan chords,
right?
Or Squeeze being like an 80s band that would kind of do the straight ahead jangle stuff, but weird chords, you know, just strange. So let me play this one spot. All right. And then we were sort of settled back down. Yeah. Any thought about writing a little bridge part like that?
Well, you mentioned Todd Rundgren. He's my favorite musician in the whole world.
Ah.
I've been accused of aping him. I will gladly take the rap. His chords are just so interesting to me because there's so many of them on piano that I learned on guitar. I don't read music. I don't know what's a seventh note from a 4/8. I don't know. I have no idea. And I don't really want to know. I've gotten to the point to where it feels like it would be, I could be wrong about that. Maybe I should, but
I don't know how you teach a second guitarist in a band. Maybe that you just don't do that anymore. But I sort of have to know, like, okay, what is that? That's a nine. You know, if I just have, or a keyboardist, as I'm playing with now, like if I haven't figured out what this thing is where I put my fingers in random places and it sounded cool, then, you know, I don't know how to chart it for them.
When I first started writing songs, I would find the notes one by one on the neck and often from a piano chord, figure out string by string where to, I might be creating new chords. I might be doing something that everyone knows how to do and I just don't know it. But I've never wanted to just do that straight up thing. Like you were mentioning about power pop being a little bit predictable sometimes, always bright, catchy, or you know, didn't have to always be bright, but it's always supposedly going to be catchy. And most of the time it is, but my definition of power pop is one of those things that most of the power pop guys would freaking hate. I think pop sounding chords and actual power have to be in there to call it power pop. So you want to find a root note that allows you to grow the branch, and you want the branch to have as many leaves on it as possible. And I'm sorry to sound like Rod McEwen there, but that just that seemed like a really good thing for me to say. I hadn't planned to say that. In certain cases, if you can add one little note by just moving your pinky up 2 frets or dropping a note or doing a different tuning, tuning one string different or whatever. If you can make something harmonic that is doable, that's something that's always been so interesting to me. And I'm still learning how to do it. And I know that I've done it before. And sometimes I think maybe that it confuses people. I don't know, but it doesn't confuse me and it makes me happy to do it. So I'm going to keep doing it.
Well, I think dramatically it's accessible to anybody as long as it's clear what the, you know, the chords can be weird as long as, oh, they're going up and now they're settling back down. Like as long as the energy levels are clear, that's how I wrote. I was briefly during college, did some composition school stuff and I didn't know 12 tone from a hole in the ground really, but I would just do things that, okay, well, it sort of symphonically makes sense. And I was even accused of like, you might want to be a little more deliberate in which notes you're choosing because it was more just sort of almost used to a punk rock kind of thing of just energy, energy, energy. Okay, now we're soothing at like that those kind of gestures. And the more adventurous the notes, I think it can even be that people just register them as some thickness. Right. They don't identify like you. Everybody knows major for minor, major seventh. That often sounds like you're on a cruise ship or something like that. But beyond that, if you're getting too fancy, it just sounds fancy, which is not bad. But
yeah, you're saying a lot of things. I need to be writing this down. I have a concept that's forming in my head right now. When you have the ability to do something, why not try it? And we learn as we grow to know what not to do, especially with drummers. A lot of that is relatable on guitar and bass, keyboards, whatever as well. But knowing what not to do, it's a special moment when you can say that you've learned that, at least to some degree.
What age were you sort of the height of your experimentation? Because I feel like it was when I was 19 is when I was trying all this stuff. And now I've kind of settled down that like, okay, this is what actually is expressive to me and I'm not gonna, but that's, I don't record as much as you do though. That the fact that you have recent albums where I can't remember which one of it, you're like, look, I don't expect, this is a concept album. I don't expect anybody to relate to it. It's going to be kind of musically esoteric. So it seems like you are still, just because you're going to the recording stuff, you know, day after day, you're going to do interesting stuff.
Well, thanks for saying that. I hope it's interesting, but I just keep going because I know how to make a song. I know this sounds trite, but if you know how to make a song, it's like, you know, you could do a cooking analogy or whatever the hell, but trusting yourself to do something that interests you. I think that's always been the case with the guys that are well revered and like Todd Rundgren is my guy and he doesn't want to worry too much about anything other than continuing to do what he does. And you can talk about it a lot and think about it and assess things here and there, but I just feel like the desire to keep doing it is my most experimental thing. I've done some things that are nuts. I mean, just ridiculous stuff. I've done some theatrical things, oh my goodness. I don't even know if I should talk about some of that, but I actually had a band called Jack Sabbath in the 90s and we did some of the goofiest things you could imagine. One of the song titles was Testicle Hung in a Plow and like just really ridiculous stuff. And I had just as much fun doing that as I've done with any other kind of music. It's just freedom.
Well, let's get that second song out there. So Intransitive Proverb from Limitations of the Source Tape, 2017. This is one that I picked. There are probably many other things in this category that might have even been a better selection, but it struck me it's Rundgren-esque quality and I wanted something significantly different than the straight ahead power pop. It's less than 3 minutes long, largely because there are very few breaks. Like you just keep barreling on to the next thing. It has a very good momentum to it. It does stop for guitar solo. Yeah. Do you want to say a little about where you were at with this album and this song before we hear it?
I appreciate you noticing the comment you made about it just barreling forward and the momentum being a part of it, because I've tried doing another bridge on that song. The first crack at it was trying to find another part, and I gave up finding that second bridge, if you will, or whatever it was going to be, because everything I came up with, while it sounded okay, just kind of changed the momentum. And I wanted that loping quality to just stay there. It's like a horse that's, you know, going about 70% of its speed. And it felt right to me to just keep it going that. My friend John Hawkins played drums on that song, and he's very good at staggering between beats. He's got a Jody Stevens Big Star kind of quality of his drumming, and just uneven but steady pacing was very attractive to me. I think I kind of got it on that song. But as far as that album goes, that's the one where I've listed the most friends. I've got several different musicians with me on that record. There's a long list. I think about 8 or 9 people helped me with that album. And it was paying respects to those folks. They've either impressed me or played my music with me, or I've been in bands with them or whatever. And here you go with thinking of what song can I do to get Scott Cornett to play a solo on? How would he fit into it? So it got to be a better album than I thought it would be, just because I was engaging with my personal influence and from people that I know, rather than trying to sound like Todd Rundgren or, you know, Big Star or whoever. I wanted to make my music fit in with some of the personalities of people that I knew. And from there, it just kept on going. And I ended up having what I thought was a pretty good record. And Bill Lloyd, who I had met by then from Foster and Lloyd, who's a great power pop and other things, singer-songwriter. He's one of the best songwriters in the world, and as far as I'm concerned, he actually introduced me to the folks at Spider Pop Records, and that was the reason why that album got a little bit of notice, because Spider Pop put it out.
Holding on with the slack intact, it can seem that it's gone so wrong, becoming just an act. I gotta laugh when I think of it, seems like it's meant to be. Never believed it could happen to me, to be aware of everything that I need. Whatever you want from me,
So yeah, no intro. Let's just get right in there and keep rolling right until we get to there's no space there either, because it's filled by the backing vocals, but at least the lead vocals stop and take a breath there, as opposed to, yes, this momentum there. Yeah. Any thoughts about the overall structure of this?
Well, there are times when you're looking at the songs you've written and you hear something by someone else and it's like, hey, I've never done that before. Or I haven't done it that way. And for that song, I know the reason that I started it with just bursting right into it and singing right off the bat with no intro is because simply that I hadn't done that, at least not to my satisfaction. And I wanted that to happen just because I hadn't done it well or at all before that. And that's often the case for me, that the whims are just as important as the actual work sometimes.
And I think I had thought, like, oh, is this an odd time signature? Is there an extra? No, it's straight. It's just the phrases seem distributed over the beats in a slightly unexpected way. You know, that's part of the melody delivery.
My wife, Lori, tells me that most of the time I refuse to start on the one. She reads music and she knows what that stuff means, but she says you're a little bit unusual because you start all over the road as far as the numbers. Like, you have 8 chances in a segment to get on a beat, and I might start at like 3.5 or something, if you could even explain what that is. But I think you know what I mean. I don't necessarily have that desire to sound typical, whether it's any good or not. I will put out a piece of crap before I'll put out something that sounds like everybody else. That's just my goal anyway.
I had made a note about the guitar solo. I can't wait for the one. I need to get in there. And let me play just from around 120 here. So we're just, as soon as you have the last syllable out, bah!
Yeah, exactly. Let's keep the train rolling.
And it sticks around in there, I think, the third song, Angel Be Mine, that we're going to talk about, where the guitar solo doesn't even stop when the vocal comes in. You have your first line, and then it does a little more, and then it's, you know, that it kind of is a unexpected visitor. It's not going to just come in on its cue and then leave after the 8 bars. It has to do something else. Any thoughts on that solo? Actually, the overall guitar sounds on this track, like, it sounded to me like you were listening to Utopia, because it has this very trebly sort of 80s guitar sound that's on top of a fuzz one, which is an interesting combination, which is not something you'd hear in 1981 necessarily.
Right. Guilty as charged. When Utopia's stuff was new and current, even then, Todd Rundgren's guitar sound was not like anybody else's. And I think I managed to make it even worse. But I enjoy just having the idea of, like, I don't necessarily need this to sound current or predictable or whatever. And not that it's any great feat, but I did achieve what I wanted as far as, like, getting something that was a little bit close to unique. I always try to do something.
The B section here comes only 15 seconds in, right? I know it's still part of the verse, but sort of you've established with the da, 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 here's the melody, and now we're gonna do a different thing, right? I gotta laugh when I think of it. Seems like it's meant to be. Every time you switch chords, it's going slightly different place than I might expect that it was going to go, and eventually settles down. But yeah, I know this was a long time ago. Do you have any thoughts about constructing that particular chain?
I think I probably was listening to a lot of Mike Viola and the Candy Butchers record at that particular time, Falling Into Place. There's a couple songs on that album that had a wealth of chords. I love a short song that has a bunch of chords that resolves well. Mm-hmm. I felt like that was probably what I was trying to do there at that point. It was 2017 when that came out. So who knows? I might have been listening to the Archies for all I know. But yeah, Mike Viola is a good example of one of those guys that can pack a bunch of chords into a song. And, you know, Squeeze, you mentioned them earlier. They're similar, but their stuff is a little more directed, repeated more. I love that too. There's nothing wrong with that. I wanted it to keep rolling forward. And for that particular song, I did have that progressive. I don't know if I should call it progressive, other than it just does keep progressing down the line. Propulsive kind of thing. That appeals to me when you can throw as many chords in there without cluttering it up.
Yeah, often you might wait until the bridge. Let's hear the bridge. So yeah, it doesn't become like we've been trotting on the road and now the bridge is where we sail off. Like, oh, it's just a different variation. It's not in a fundamentally different world. Yeah. How do you see bridge? Do you have a philosophy of bridges? And especially when you're doing a chord packed song like this, where you're not saving the craziness for the bridge.
Yeah. I was actually going to put another one in there, like I said earlier, and it just seemed to stymie that flow a bit. But as far as generally speaking, in terms of any kind of rock and roll music that sounds anything like pop, I cannot tell you how many songs I would be like, man, I would really love that song if it just had a bridge. I think if you can't have at least two parts to your song, it's just a groove. Plenty of great pieces of music out there that do that. There's nothing but two or three chords and they never change. I'm not hating on that whole idea, but for me, I'm going to try to do one more thing, and it's a disease. I'm not proud of it. It's just something I can't not do. And I blame Todd.
Well, now you got me thinking that where from this bridge, I could very easily, yes, hear it drop into yet another key change or something and exist here and then try to eventually make its way back to make it a longer trip here. I don't know, were you seeing this? Had I noticed this was less than 3 minutes, maybe I wouldn't have picked it, but I think I had, because I often, you know, oh, is it going to be meaty enough? But, you know, you've got just about as many lyrics in this as you do in the other one, just because of the pace at which things are happening. Were you thinking of this song in sequence on the album, like that it could be short? Okay, so it really is a self-contained piece.
I rarely think about sequence until I've got everything recorded. I generally go from 9 or 10 to 14 or so. And if some of them don't belong on the album, I'll know it when I listen to them all together. And then I start working on track order. I don't think about it until that point. And I'm very lucky to have Lori there for many other reasons. Plus this, she's great at determining a track order, giving me her version of it and telling me why she thinks this should go there and so on. And I've pretty much listened to her on every album I've made since I've been with her. She's like, no, you want to keep climbing. It's almost like she's arguing with the movie High Fidelity, where they describe how to make the perfect mixtape. If Lori was in that conversation, and she's taken a lot of good parts out of that and got her own thing, because I get lost. I just do the songs unless I'm doing something like my Echoism record, which was,
that's exactly what I was looking at. And that's the, what I had referred to before as this thing that
everything was because I hadn't done it before. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do that concept album where everything was planned and done in order. So I put these tasks on myself. Otherwise, for just straight up records with a bunch of songs on them, I never think about the tracking order until I'm done recording all the songs.
Well, let's go back to Your Own Chosen Speed 2001, which you had described as the first real album you did. Something like the first good cohesive album I'd ever made.
I still stand by that. I think I really like that record, and I always will. I thought that was the first batch of where I got 10 songs that I'm not going to skip one of them. That was just me and my late great brother. He played drums and I played everything else, and had a pretty decent batch of songs, and I proceeded to overproduce every one of them in our little crappy recording space. I had a Tascam 8-track reel-to-reel tape player, and one of the tracks was out, so I really recorded that album on 7 tracks and just made as much happen, just ruined every track as much as I could, taking samples from TV shows and just making all these little nods to where my head was at that point. But the songs themselves kind of hold up.
Yeah, so the one that I picked was Angel Be Mine, which at its core is another power pop with less good lyrics than you had. You know, this is like Baby Blue, a similar kind of thing. But it has this intro and outro that have these recorded bits and basically you guys being the Who with Mike doing some pretty crazy stuff and you soloing very fast. I just wanted to, you're doing the Guitar Hero thing here, which doesn't seem to be something that you lean heavily into in other places too much.
I've only written a few songs that are that twee in terms of like the Monkees and Archies kind of power pop thing that a lot of bands do. Nothing against that, but I don't excel at that. But when I do, which is very rare, I have to throw some dirty water on it. I can't keep it that clean. And we decided that we were going to just go ahead and jam on that one little groove that kind of goes with everything else in the song. And it turned out that we used it at the start and again at the end. At the end, I brought in Orson Welles.
Ah, that's what that is. Okay. That also, he's talking at the beginning, or this is from multiple sources, the close your eyes and concentrate thing.
Yes. Yeah, that was Orson Welles from different movies. It's not just one.
Okay.
We decided that that would be funny. I can't even tell you why, but at that time it was hilarious.
Close your eyes. Concentrate.
All right. Yes. Yeah. Anything you're noticing in this tune that, oh, I don't write things quite like that anymore? Like, definitely if I throw a song from 1993 on a current album, people know, like, that doesn't really sound like the same person wrote it. Do you still feel like I could have written this yesterday?
I do, because I have a default setting that would allow me to rip off any Beatles song. And not with any kind of talent, but just I got it. I understand that. And I could switch that on and write a terrible song that would, if you were clever enough, you could stick it in with a bunch of power pop records. I've done that since, but not too many times. But that one was so light. The lyrical content is completely just throwaway stuff. I can't live without you, baby, kind of thing. And I want you to be mine. You're an angel.
You said a flame burning in my soul, just so you know.
Yeah, exactly. I was not going to record it, but when we had that idea, and that was the first take, everything you hear except samples and, you know, the added guitars was first take. And I was like, I'm keeping this bastard. I really like this.
So you had shredded enough that you could just pull this out way back in 2001.
Yeah, we were simpatico in ways that only brothers can be. It's like if I told him, let's make this sound like blank, he just knew. There were sometimes he didn't want to do it, and he would get grumpy about it, but that's the way brothers are too. So we had a second language, and it's like, is this going to work? Vast majority of the time when you do that, you're toiling over it. You're doing it for 3, 4, 20 times, and not quite happening here. Let's try it again with a little bit of emphasis on this part right here, whatever. We didn't really do that. It was either going to work on the second, third take. By then, he's just never going to want to play it again. He's just so bored so fast. I respect that now more than I did, not just because I miss him, but also because he was right. This is not, we're not Tchaikovsky, you know, we're not working on some classic monument of sound here. This is a stupid pop song. What can we do to it that makes it less stupid? Let's just rock it and rip the guts out of it. And hey, that wasn't too bad. And it's my decision at that point as to whether or not I'm going to let anybody else hear it. I'm sticking with it. That was one of them that I know it's stupid, but I still like it.
Let me play just the first verse here. I just wanted us to get the transition into the chorus there. Dun, dun, dun. That's very, you know, heavily telegraphed, and having that responding, you know, we're not just going to let it, we're going to answer it with a dun, 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 that's sort of just as prominent as the vocal line. So this is also actually kind of like the last song, because of that, is not actually giving you space. Like, we're going to just make it as if you were singing continuously. It's just that some of the time it's guitar. Yeah. And he I guess that's just part of the concision ethic that you got going here.
That's true. That's a good point. But it's also not wanting to play anything that would bore my brother. I wanted to get through this take. I wanted to see what we could do here without him saying, dropping his sticks 2 minutes in and saying, this sucks. Because that would happen sometimes. But also, the song itself is more like a, hey, Matthew Sweet. Hey, Tommy King. You guys got nothing on this kind of stupid. I'm going to show you guys that I can write a song like you, but much dumber. You give yourself these little challenges, and some of them are ridiculous. And to me, that's freedom. I've always loved having fun with it. I don't take any of it all that seriously to begin with. It's something I have to do, you know. You're an artist, you've got to keep doing it.
Let me play a little of the solo. So very concise solo, and very much unlike the shredding you were doing at the beginning. So it's like, yeah, that was just a different song.
Yeah. At the end, it's maniacal. So you got to throw a vegetable in with the meat to make the meal work out.
I'm trying to think, do Rolling Stones actually have guitar solos? Like, they certainly have things that like that, like what we just heard, that, you know, get us quickly from one section to another. But it's not like the Elliot Easton in the Cars coming in and like, oh, here's this well-constructed solo. What is your guitar soloing philosophy, I guess?
Well, a lot of songs, and I love when they just repeat the melody line. A lot of songs that or the guitar solo is just repeating what the singer sang on the verse. I like that to a large degree, and I've done that plenty of times. Sometimes it's better to just freeform it, but it has to work. So if you can spend enough time working on it and make it still sound sprightly, then I'm okay with putting a little extra time in there. But for me, most of the time, I don't spend too long with it, but it has to follow a framework where you know what notes you're playing, you know what notes are going to sound at least decent. Now just make them stack up right. You can do something weird midway through it and recover from that just fine. But I think it's either going to be something that's pretty much in the moment or real close to that melody line for me. If I'm going to like it and appreciate it, play it over and over, you get tired of playing the same thing unless that same thing just works so well that you can't imagine anything else going there.
Yeah, so sort of it's the Neil Young, which is he plays very nicely and melodically, but I'm sure it's very much off the cuff. When I actually sat down to learn just what I needed by the Cars, the solo, like the majority of the notes are bent up.
Right.
Like you have to have that plan. You can bend up to a note, but if all of them in a line are bent up, that means you planned that out.
You take such a great example of that too. That song, Elliot Easton is going up, 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 but he also tells everyone the trick of that, which is, I'm going to hum this, but everyone knows this solo. So he goes, nah, 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 nah. Most of that's going up, but then right there he goes, nah. He has like these three quick notes that drop it off and then you start all over again. So it's build, 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 drop it back down. You can drop it all the way down if you want to be dramatic. You can drop it a little bit to stay on course. It's so much fun to just decide what you're going to do if you can do it.
Yep, yep. I just think even that lower note, though, is bent up from like that he's not playing on the fret that would get you that note. He's playing one or two less. That most people that learn to play that by just ear, like, do not play it right, according to the... Anyway, this is digressing. You know, let's wrap up here. I wanted to make sure we heard. We're just going to introduce and say goodbye, and then people will get to hear. I just picked the first song from the first album from Dang. So it's Tartarus, The Darkest Realm, 2014, and it's Sisyphus,
right,
which is, as somebody who runs a philosophy podcast, my audience will be very familiar with the story of Sisyphus and all you could make of it. And you said a little bit about your approach to these songs. Yeah, do you want to say a little more about Dang, its history, its present status, how it fits in with the rest of what you do?
Well, Scott, I've mentioned him a couple of times. He's my best buddy, and he's in both Flat Earth and Dang. I wanted to do some more of that progressive metal type stuff that we did with Flat Earth, and it had been a number of years. So what can I do lyrically? My wife and I talked about some things, and I landed on Greek mythology, and the more I started writing about it, the more, I guess, tongue-in-cheek or a little bit lighthearted it became to talk about these horrible stories, people trapped in the darkest level of Hades. And you get to that point where you're like, okay, how are we going to do this? It was pretty easy, really, because he and I and the other two guys, Brian Beaver and Matt Lutton, decided to just try to come up with as many heavy metal sounding riffs as we could and put them in a blender and come up with songs. I wrote the entire first album, but they co-wrote the second album, and that's what we've done. And right now, I don't want to say this album's definitely coming out or when, but I have started to revisit some of that. It's been quite a while since I've done anything with Dang. But from the very first moment when we started doing this, we wanted to keep that sense of humor in there. And Dang is a pretty funny name if you're being silly. But we put the umlaut on the A.
Sure.
Because in all these European
Who's
countries,
you? Yes.
It can be pronounced dung or dong. And the really ridiculous joke therein is something that has confused. When that came out, it came out on a really big record label for the metal side of things, No Remorse Records. And I feel bad because they thought we were actually going to be more committed to this, but they didn't know what a chameleon I was, I guess. But I got interviewed. They set up interviews, and I never admitted the truth to any of those people about the name. But it was just a joke. It was just to make Europeans say the word wrong. And we started from that level of ridiculousness and went forward. After two albums, it just felt like I needed to do something else for a while. And that's where I've been for the last, I don't know, 5-6 albums, but there's life in there. I do have some demos going. We'll see what happens.
Well, yes. Much earlier in this discussion, I referred to something, to the first song as, oh, now we've revealed it's jokey character. But to me, jokey and joyful are sort of the same thing. And likewise, you know, pretending in a tongue-in-cheek way to do over-the-top heavy metal, well, you're still doing over-the-top heavy metal. Like, it doesn't mean that you're dismissing the genre or making fun of it. You know, it's, you can make fun of it and still participate in it because it is fun.
We take the music and the playing of it very seriously in terms of getting it done correctly. We're making an effort there. And I feel like I'm probably making an effort, but it's almost like a bad comedian stepping up in front of a great band. Those guys are all better musicians than me, and it just works. I think there may be another album at some point, but I do have some demos that I'm starting working on.
Are there other irons in the fire, things that you're working on, other collaborations? I noticed you've had a few one-off collaborations just in, even in the last 5-10 years. With different band names.
My wife, Laura, is Lady Darkville. And there's an album of music that we did with Brian, the drummer from Dang. We've just recorded a brand new song that we wrote together. And it is going to be on Big Stir Records' vinyl compilation for Halloween that they're working on. Mm. There will be a new Lady Darkville song that comes out somewhere before October on Big Stir's project. And it'll be on vinyl. So I'm pretty excited about hearing that. I'm in a band with Scott, my buddy, the Scott Cornett Trio, if you want to check that out. It's mostly instrumental, but the songs that do have vocals on them, Lindsay Murray's on a few of those. So the Scott Cornett Trio has quite a few things. It's all on Bandcamp.
Is there a live unit of some sort?
Not currently. I got too many irons in the fire, and I'm not enjoying playing in front of people too much, but I will do the odd gig. I've got a gig coming up with the Long Players, a superstar cover band that does these classic albums all the way through, and then they'll come back and play a second set with more songs by the same artist. And we're doing Neil Young's Harvest on June 7th in Nashville. And I'm fortunate enough to go out there.
With Bill Lloyd, right? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. He mentioned this project at the end of my interview with him as well, that he was excited to have another.
He includes me on some of those. And this time around, Walter Egan will be there, and Dan Baird from Georgia Satellites, and Jason Ringenberg from Jason and the Scorchers. It's going to be a pretty good one, I think. So I'll take that gig. But other than that, I haven't really tried to play live very much in the last few years.
All right. Well, I will link to, I saw there was at least one video of you with Bill with that band live from a past thing. And as there was a live Dang, a gig before the first album was recorded. So people can see some of these things, and you playing solo and in front of at a church with a bunch of people. There's something with
that was an old Catholic church that was turned successfully into a recording studio. And I think I was one of three people that they did a live show like that with. I enjoyed that a lot. Got to regroup with some people I'd played with in the past, but that was for an album I recorded there.
Well, real pleasure listening through your catalog. Thanks so much for talking to me.
Mark, I appreciate it, man. Thanks. It's great to meet you.
All right. Here's Sisyphus by Dang from Tartarus, the Darkest Realm. Thanks so much to Chris. Chris is, I believe, someone who Facebook's algorithm pointed me to, as came up in our interview. I have interviewed Lindsay Murray from Gretchen Wheel, who sings on this album, as well as Bill Lloyd, who also plays in this album and who runs that group of the Long Players that Chris mentioned at the end there. And Big Stir Records is also the home of Graham Parker on his latest album, who I had on the show not too long ago. So, good label, very sharp, nice-sounding album. And despite the fact that he's getting help from a label, he's very much an indie artist who has not gotten discouraged by the lack of widespread acclaim, though he has gotten some very good press recently. So, someone I very much admire for his work ethic, for his keeping at it in a way that I really have not. I'm continuing to grind in rehearsals to work toward perhaps having my new album done by the end of summer, but we'll see. If you look at Chris's Bandcamp page, that is chrischurch1.bandcamp.com, you will behold his vast back catalog, including those many solo albums, but also an album by the band Chalky, which is Chris and a guy named John Hawkins. You can hear his old bands like Junk Flower and Flat Earth, and another very short-lived old project, Frank Burns. There is a single attributed to the Whateverly Brothers. He's released singles of several cover tunes, including a Todd Rundgren song, and Lady Darkevil, spelled D-A-R-K-E-V-Y-L, and Dang with an umlaut. Those are also on Bandcamp on their own pages. Chris has done several interesting videos. I will link to many of these things from the blog post associated with this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. I hope you are subscribed directly to the Nakedly Examined Music podcast feed, or better yet, at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, where you'll hear these episodes without ads and get a link to my notes for the episode with the lyrics and structures. Hope you're doing well. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.